There's the whack-a-mole, and then there's the bug splat, which is what they see on their screens when they squish somebody. You kill somebody, and it looks like a bug, and so the victim is the bug splat. And the people who are running away when the drones strike are called squirters, and oftentimes they double tap, it's called. So you hit first time, and you hit the bug splat, and then you hit the second time to get the squirters. What that results in, the U.S. killing people who are running in to rescue the first people who were hit. So it's dehumanization on almost a surreal kind of level, and you don't even have to be training people to hate the enemy, because now it's just a game.
Tell us more about the game. Tell us more about the pilots and to understand how this works.
It was on purpose that the manufacturers of the drones created the console that would be just like the video games platforms that teenagers grew up using. And they recruit, actually, from high schools and find that those are who are most nimble at this are people who have been playing war games for a long time. And the UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killings has said that the U.S. is creating a PlayStation mentality towards war, and that is certainly what's happening. If you're sitting in an air-conditioned room in an ergonomic chair in the desert in Las Vegas and killing people 10,000 miles away, it's really hard to, I think, tell yourself that it's real, that it seems very much like a game. And the other thing that the pilots have told me when I have had a chance to talk to these remote control pilots is that it's really, really boring. They're just sitting and looking at a screen hour after hour after hour. And these planes are hovering over a compound or over a rural area for not only hours at a time, sometimes days at a time. So one of their biggest problems is boredom. In fact, they said they'd love to be in the battlefield. They'd rather be out there in the action. They join the military because they want a piece of the action. And here they are sitting in a chair in a room thousands of miles away. I think they enjoy when they are able to provide the intelligence to the troops on the ground by doing the surveilling with the drones. And then they're talking in real time to the troops on the ground and feeling like they're part of the firefight and the action. But when they're just sitting in front of the screen day in and day out, they're looking for suspicious behavior because they want to kill somebody. And on top of that, you're taking young people who've oftentimes never been out of the country, don't even speak another languages, much less the language of the people they're trying to kill, certainly have no understanding of their culture. And so the simplest things can look suspicious. Men sitting around in a circle and talking to each other and holding hands, as is the cultural norm in northern Pakistan, look like people who are sitting and plotting some terrible plot against the U.S. And there are a number of examples that I give in the book of mistakes. The other thing you should think about is how many failures were there in the people that we captured and took to Guantanamo. And that was a case of our intelligence on the ground being so faulty that 80% of the people who were in Guantanamo were found to be innocent and released. Yet we were told by Dick Cheney at that time that these were the worst of the worst. And then you look at Afghanistan, where we've had boots on the ground for 10 years, and we're still going after the wrong people. We're still killing innocent people. And then think of the intelligence where we don't have boots on the ground. How bad is that intelligence? Well, we see it in the case of Yemen, for example, when the former dictator, Ali Abdullah Saleh, was telling the United States, oh, go get that guy over there, and he's al-Qaeda, and this guy's al-Qaeda, and this guy's al-Qaeda. And the U.S. is obediently going around and killing whoever the dictator is saying is al-Qaeda, and it turns out they're just his political enemies that are rising up trying to overthrow a dictator. So the U.S. has been using faulty intelligence, and there's no reason to think that whether it's the pilot sitting in an Air Force base outside of Las Vegas or if it's President Obama sitting in the White House looking at baseball cards on Terror Tuesday, that really they really have very little idea about who they're putting on a kill list.
So we're talking about drones now, but there's something that sounds very resonant with how the atomic bomb was sold, how fear was whipped up, how it was supposed to be a worst weapon that would never be used again. And there's something about drones being promoted as this kind of a sales job that resonates with the A-bomb. Any sort of connection in your mind as far as the cultural and ideological buy-in for this?
There's similarities and differences. Similarities are that each new technological development in warfare is supposed to be a way to end war, and that's how it's sold to us. And each one is supposed to be a more civilized way of saying that if we have the A-bomb, we will deter other people from going to war. The difference is that in the case of drones, it's such a more simple technology. It's so much easier to get your hands on it, whether you're a state that's buying them or duplicating them. We have the example of the most sophisticated drone that the U.S. has in terms of a spy drone is a drone that the Iranians hacked into and brought it down and have now duplicated. And Iran was already developing its own drones and selling them to non-state entities like Hezbollah and working with the Venezuelan government of Hugo Chavez to have their own factory to develop their own drones. So the U.S. Might think that it's able to control this new technology, and it is one of the few things that the U.S. continues to be number one in manufacturing. But there is such a proliferation of drones, way more than in the case of nuclear weapons, and easy not only for large organizations or states to have, but for individuals to have as well. I mean, you're not going to go in your backyard and build your own nuclear bomb, but you can go in your backyard and build your own drone. In fact, the drones that are used to kill people now were first developed in somebody's garage.
So it sounds like you're saying, in a way, the genie's out of the bottle, in a way that people used to talk about the atomic bomb. Are there depleted uranium tips on, I mean, is there any kind of nuclear capabilities for the drones? Is there a crossover that way? What's your sense of that direction?
Drones can carry anything. It's a question of weight. And of course, you have the big drones and small drones. So they could carry nuclear weapons, theoretically. There's always also experimentation to have nuclear-powered drones. In both of those cases, it's seen as not very advisable because since these drones crash a lot, you could suddenly have a dirty bomb someplace very different than where you intended it to go. But the drones can carry just about any kind of weapon you want them to carry.
As far as the buying and the selling of the technology and the equipment, what corporations are involved?
The corporation that's most known for the killer drones, the Predator and Reaper drones, is General Atomics, which is in Southern California, originally founded by an Israeli engineer who worked for the Israeli military, came to the United States, started his own company that got sold and then got sold again and became General Atomics. There's a smaller company in California known as AeroVironment that's producing a lot of the small drones and uses this biomimicry to take the beauty of nature and try to replicate it and turn it into drones. And then there's the usual, the big guys on the block, and that's the Raytheon and the Boeing and the Northrop Grumman. They are making drone parts. They're making the sensors for the drones. They're making new missiles to strap onto the drones. Everybody wants a piece of the drone pie. And now, since there are so many different kinds of drones, Just about every single weapons company is involved in drone productions. I think when they heard the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, say drones were the only game in town, they wanted to make sure they were part of the game.
And it sounds like it's a growth market. Can you give us a sense of the scale of you know, what sort of scale is this industry and where's it going?
It's about a $6 billion industry right now, and it's planned to double by 2018, and we'll probably just keep doubling every couple of years because there's so many potential uses for drones. And, you know, we should be clear that there's good drones and bad drones. And in the potential for good drones, there's all kinds of things that commercial groups want to use drones for. Real estate agents want to use them for surveilling land. Post offices might use them for delivering the mail, as well as all kinds of messenger services. Farmers want to use them for spraying their crops, and cattle ranchers want to use them for finding their cattle. And there are restaurants that have talked about using them to deliver your lunch, although they can't figure out how to keep it warm or to keep you from stealing their drone once you got the lunch. So there's all kinds of potentials. And then there's environmentalists who use drones to catch whalers on the high seas, Brazilian government using drones to catch illegal logging in the Amazon, forest fighters trying to use drones to pin down where the fire is coming from. So there's all those potential uses. But what is driving the drone industry right now is the killing and the spying. And it's in the spying where the drone manufacturers see tremendous possibilities. They would love to see every police department in the United States have at least a drone, if not a fleet of drones. And you can imagine all these private detectives, they would all love drones. I mean, you could watch your husband, your wife, your boyfriend, your girlfriend. I mean, there's all kinds of things you could do to spy on people with drones.
So what's holding back the further proliferation? And tell us more about the drone lobby and the drone caucus. You've used those terms. Could you sort of talk about that?
The drone manufacturers, although they compete with each other, they also understand the capitalist way is you come together as a lobby while you're competing with each other. And that lobby has become a very powerful lobby. And they do what lobbies do. They go to Congress. They go to the White House. They push their issues, but they've been so successful in the case of Congress that they managed to get 58 members of Congress, mostly Republicans, but also Democrats, including some liberal Democrats, to join a caucus. And it says in the mission statement that the job of that caucus is to push the urgent need to push for the further deployment of unmanned aerial vehicles, both overseas and in the United States, for law enforcement and commercial ends. So this drone caucus has written new legislation, passed it through Congress, signed by the Obama administration, February 14th of 2012, Valentine's Day, a big present for the drone industry, to say that you must start issuing lots and lots and lots, thousands of permits for drones. And the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, has been reluctant because they know the drones crash. There's nobody up in the sky that's looking around to see who else is up in the sky. And so there have been billions of dollars that are now being put into retooling the industry so that drones can be incorporated into our airspace by the end of September at 2015 at the latest, and before that for law enforcement agencies. So right now we have police stations, they're experimenting with drones, FBI has drones, Border Security has drones, Homeland Security has drones, but this is still in the experimental stage. And unless we do something about it, we are going to see tens of thousands of drones in our own airspace, many of them used to spy and surveil the American people.
But given the economy and the strapped budgets of police departments, how can municipalities afford these?
Very good question. And that's what the sheriff's departments are asking themselves. They're saying, hey, we're getting cuts. We're having to cut the pensions of our officers. We don't have money for these drones. And there comes Homeland Security to the rescue and says, hey, we got lots of money. We'll give you a couple of hundred thousand here, a couple of hundred thousand there. You buy these drones, you test them out. We'll train your officers on how to use them. And lo and behold, you get a police station that's hooked on drones. And of course, the neighboring police station says, hey, how come they have drones and we don't? We got to keep up with the Joneses. And they want their drone. So I would say Homeland Security is playing the role of the drug pusher in trying to hook our law enforcement agencies on drones and wanting to see it spread and working hand in glove with the drone industry.
You've talked about Terror Tuesdays. What is that?
Well, it seems that Terror Tuesdays is when President Obama gathers the guys in the White House, and they're probably almost all guys, and they sit around and look at who's going to be on the kill list. So they have the profiles and the pictures of people, and it seems that it's sort of like baseball cards. They're flipping through, and they're discussing each person, and they're playing this role of prosecutor, of judge, of jury, and of executioner, deciding who's going to get on the kill list, who's going to be targeted by our drones. These can be people as young as 17 years old or as old as 80-something, whatever. It can be men and women, but it's mostly men. And we know very little about them because this is a secretive process, but just the idea that our president is playing this kind of a role of deciding who's going to live and who's to die on the basis of such little information and understanding is quite astounding. And when the present and past members of the Obama administration talked to the New York Times about this, it seems it was part of an election strategy that they wanted to make the president look like a tough guy and make sure that these independent voters who might be still a little squeamish about is President Obama some kind of socialist or not, would be reassured that he is as tough as it comes, that he can make these decisions, that he can put people on the kill list, even if they're American citizens. And they said it's very easy for him. He doesn't do a lot of hand-wringing. Interesting, after that piece came out, that the reactions were not as perhaps the Obama administration has planned. One is that there is a lot of people who are actually horrified by this idea, this whole image that it conjures up of what our president is doing. And then the administration had to deal with something else, which is how come these people were leaking this to the press? If this is such a super secret program that Congress is not allowed to talk about it, not even to mention the word drones when it comes to killing, then how come people in the administration were able to do it? And so you got the Republicans saying, lordy, lordy, where are these leaks coming from? We've got to have a special prosecutor. We got to investigate this. And then you have Democrats who felt they had to fall in line, too, and say, oh, my goodness, these leaks, isn't it terrible? Well, think about that for a minute. The response of Congress is, oh, my goodness, who is leaking this information and telling the American public what our government's really doing, instead of, oh, my goodness, look at what they're doing. A kill list, Terror Tuesdays, baseball cards, the CIA gone wild, a killing spree on an industrial scale. What is happening in this White House, and what are we going to do to stop it? No, that was not the reaction of our Congress.
Medea, you've been a longtime activist for peace. You're very active now in the campaign to stop weaponized drones. Could you tell us about the Creech 14 and some of the long-time protests and sort of from the side of this where we do see people becoming aware and outraged, even if you're saying Congress is not concerned?
The conscience of this nation is not coming from the White House. It's not coming from Congress. It's not coming anywhere from Washington. It's really coming from outlying areas in this country where people are beginning to stand up to these atrocities. And many people have discovered that the Air Force bases in their communities are where these drone pilots are being trained or the drones are being operated, and they have become outraged and decided to protest against it. And one group is a group that was protesting outside the Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. And it was on Good Friday. They crossed the line into the base. They asked the people on the base to have a meal with them. The folks on the base were not too interested in breaking bread with these good Catholics, and many of them were from the Catholic worker community, and decided instead to have them arrested. They then used their trial in a very beautiful way to bring on these issues of international law, of the obligation to violate laws that are not just. And they brought in members of the international community who are known for their expertise in international law, and turned the courtroom really into an educational session about drones, the violation of international law, the violation of our Constitution. And the example of that group in Creech was then replicated by a group in upstate New York in the Air Force Base called Hancock, where 35 of them did something similar. And many of them, again, part of the Catholic community known as Catholic workers. And they got arrested and in turn used their trial as a platform for talking about these larger issues. And that has inspired other groups then to do similar kinds of actions at other Air Force bases. And I find as I travel around the country that these are really the heart and soul of our nation, the people who do care about the lives of innocent people overseas and are willing to put their own lives at risk, willing to go to jail for their beliefs. And there are more and more of them as people are becoming more and more aware of the drone program. And not only are they at Air Force bases, but they're also protesting at the headquarters of the drone manufacturers. They're doing die-ins in the offices of these drone manufacturers. And they're going into Congress to protest when the drone lobby is exhibiting these weapons in the halls of Congress. They're popping up at press conferences by the drone industry to speak out on behalf of the victims, and looking for venues where we can bring out this, I would call, prophetic voice to say no to the killings.
So just very briefly, tell us about the drone-free zones. What are those?
Well, the fact that there may well be drones coming to every community in this country if we don't do something about it has sparked a new movement to get the discussion going at the local level by trying to pass local resolutions saying that drones will not be used in our community to spy on us and to violate our privacy rights. And there's a sample resolution on our website called droneswatch.org. And there are a number of different communities that are trying to get this passed now. And another thing that's happening, I think that's very exciting, because all you have to do is dial a number on your phone, and that is people calling their police departments and asking very simple questions. Do you have any drones? Do you have any plans to buy any drones? If you do, where will the money come from for those drones? And what are the plans in place to make sure that our privacy rights are respected? And then, of course, to say, why do we need these drones in the first place? So we are working with the Electronic Frontier Foundation that has launched this, I think, very exciting campaign for people to call their local police departments. So there's things you can do from the simplest giving a call or getting the dialogue going by passing a resolution locally to talking to your congresspeople. And I know people are tired of talking to congresspeople. They don't see a lot of benefit out of it. But let me tell you, Congress is not hearing enough about this issue. In fact, they're just starting to hear about this issue. I would say in the beginning of 2012, when we started talking about drones and going to Congress, the congresspeople would say, what? Why do you care about this issue? Nobody in my constituency is telling me about it. 6 months later, I would say by June 2012, the situation is really starting to change very dramatically. In fact, there are examples of Republican congresspeople saying that I was shopping in Walmart when people approached me and wanted to know what are we doing about these drones, and I'm very concerned about them. I thought that was a pretty funny example of this issue reaching middle America. But there's so many examples now of congresspeople on the left and the right who are being asked by their constituents, why are we having these Homeland Security give money to police departments to surveil us? And why is the government buying more and more of these drones? And we think that it's time to cut the budgets. And a lot of these people are small government kind of people. And so they're going at it from the point of view that we don't want Big Brother and we don't want big government. And I think this gives us an opportunity to reach out left, right, Democrat, Republican, independent, Ron Paul supporters, and to focus a lot on trying to stop the drones from invading our own community. And then we can make the connections between stopping the drones from killing other people overseas.